It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Alaska Tracks. My name is Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. Today's episode features Al Wright of Fairbanks. Al was a major player in interior aviation from the 1940s to the 1980s. You can still find his business, Wright Air Service, on the east ramp out at the Fairbanks Airport, although Al sold the business many years ago. In this first segment, Al explains how his flying career got started.
18, I was trying to get in the military, but they kept giving me deferments to work on these construction jobs. So I never got in the Army until about 1944. Went through boot camp and training down in Anchorage, and then they shipped me around the country, and we were headed for the South Pacific. Ended up in the Aleutian Islands. That was about my military career. I got out in June of 46. They had the GI Bill, and everybody was able to go to school or learn to fly or whatever under the GI Bill. So I signed up for that right away and learned to fly. I got a little T-craft right off the bat. I was working for a construction outfit here in Fairbanks, Mitchell Truck and Tractor. I earned enough money to buy this airplane. Then I started flying trappers. And the first trip I had was a guy came in there looking for somebody to pick his fur up. He'd been trapping all winter up on the Ladue River. He was trying to find somebody to go get his fur. He'd walked out over to Northway and then got a ride into town. We were sitting there shooting the bull. All these kids that were learning to fly and nobody wanted to go. I said, well, I'll go. That was my first big flying job. Of course, I was just a private pilot then. We had to go to Northway and fuel up because there wasn't enough gas to get to Ladue and back to here. It was pretty well down the Ladue River towards the Yukon, and big tall spruce on both sides. It was a narrow river and it had gone dry. He had some beaver traps set out when he left. He just left them there set because he knew he was coming back. So he says, well, we're going to have to stay overnight. Of course, we had to anyway, because we had to snowshoe a runway to get off, because that airplane had little narrow skis, and they'd sink right to the bottom. Every time I'd land someplace, I'd have to snowshoe a runway. Anyway, he picked up the beaver traps and got three or four beaver, but he had all kinds of marten and lynx, and we had that little airplane. Every corner we could find it, we had stuffed with fur, you know, just jammed full. Mostly marten, good marten too. So we go back to Northway and gas up and get back in here. Then he says, well, I'll find a fur buyer and then pay you for the trip. So the next day he came out and paid me. And that's mainly how I got started flying. And then there was all kinds of trappers figured that was the way to go. I was still living in Nenana, but I was working up here. So I moved back to Nenana and started hauling some trappers out of there, mainly the Kantishnam and Chumana area. Then out of Minto, hauled a lot of those natives out of there trapping, because I knew most of them from when we lived there. And so I didn't do much trapping from then on. I'd fly these trappers out and pick them up and haul their supplies and their dog teams. They'd generally have four or five dogs, and we'd stuff them in the airplane and all their stuff, and then tie the sled on the ski to haul it out, because it'd save them a lot of time breaking trail to get out there. It's actually cheaper for them to fly out than it was to drive themselves out, because they'd waste all that trapping time. Then I started flying fur buyers around. I flew Johnny Schwegler quite a bit, Muskrat Johnny. He was an old weaseled up little guy, worked for New York Fur Exchange. So he knew everybody in the whole country. He'd gone over this whole country by dog team before the war. That's the way he traveled. So then he started flying after that.
Okay, so Al was off to a good start. Let's listen to where it goes from here. Remember that equipment back then was not as reliable as what we have today.
I was testing it out. This guy was going to sell it to me. Jack Coghill had to go to Nenana, and I was going to take him back. So I says, well, that'd be a good time to check this airplane out. So I had him and his wife. They weren't married yet. And she was babysitting for somebody. He had a little baby. You know, kids are young, they don't think about anything. So she was going to ride down, and then Donna Huprich was going to go along just for the ride. And I'd never been in that airplane before. This guy was trying to sell it, and so I was in the driver's seat, and he was coaching me on the other side. So we're heading for Nenana, and we get a little over halfway down, and oil starts showing up on the windshield. And it got thicker and thicker, and I said, we're going to have to land this thing. We'll never make it to Nenana. So I see across the river a big willow patch. I started heading across to land in those willows. Figured it was the softest place. And by then I couldn't see out the windshield. It was oil all over it. So there's a little side window on those, and you can roll them down. So I rolled that window down. I could stick my head out the side and see what was in front. And as I started to go across the river, I looked back, and there's a sandbar there that looked good enough to land on. Big drift pile on the other end of it. I said, we can make it in there. So I turned the airplane around real quick and told this guy to put the flaps down. I didn't even know where the flap handle was, and got it on the ground. But I knew this drift pile was on the end, and there's all them jill pokes, and they're heading downstream, and we're landing upstream. They really do a job on you. When we're getting close, I couldn't see no more because my eyes got full of oil. So I just ground looped the airplane because I didn't want to run into that pile. Kind of nosed up, but it fell down and it didn't hurt anything. What happened is a prop seal went out and all the oil came out. But I was talking to Nenana, and I told him we were landing on a bar up there and see if you could get somebody to come get us. So they got a hold of old Bill Lavery. He had a 108 on floats. So he came down there and he hauled all my passengers to Nenana and came back up and got me a new prop seal and some tools, brought them back down. We put a new seal in, and he brought some oil too. Took off and went to Nenana and picked up my passengers and came back to Fairbanks.
That was back before FAA days.
Yeah, there was just two of them around here. But they had a hard time of keeping track of everybody.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot more of that just mechanicking right on the spot in the bush if necessary.
Yeah. I've changed a lot of engines out in the bush. Anyway, that girl didn't tell the parents about having that kid on the airplane until he was about 20 years old.
I have to say, that was one of the most harrowing flying stories I've ever heard. This next segment contains another equipment failure, although not as serious as the last one.
Of course, I had lots of little mishaps on the way, like breaking a landing gear, bending the propeller. Fall of 49, I had a Gullwing Stinson. I was going into Nenana with it, and I had one passenger with me, and the airplane caught on fire. I was about 500 feet up in the air. Just come circling town to attract a ride. So I headed for the runway right away, and I told this guy, he was sitting in the back because I had a load of lumber. I was building a house down there. So I was actually loaded tail heavy, only thing that saved us. He was sitting on this back seat, and I had a big down sleeping bag that I carried, used it for seat cushion plus emergency gear. And when the fire started, smoke started coming in. We were only a mile from the runway. I hollered at him when the thing first started. I said, unhook your seat belt and get ready to bail out. And I said, I'm going to try to make it to the runway. And if we do, I said, just bail out. Be better than burning up. I started to turn to go to the runway. And the whole thing blew inside in smoke and flames. And we had heavy clothes on, winter clothes. It was in November. And that airplane was cold anyway. So I pulled my hood up over my head so I wouldn't get burned, and he wrapped up in that sleeping bag. about that time, I couldn't see the instruments anymore on the panel. And I figured it was all over. Last thing I saw on the gauges, we were going 130 miles an hour. And we were down to 300 feet. That's the last thing I could see. So I just shut the engine off and tried to hold the airplane straight. Then I felt the thing quit flying. We fell for at least 200 feet without any fabric on the wings or fuselage. It all burned off. It had that nitrate dope, and it's just like a powder keg. Once it starts, it just goes poof, and it's gone. So we hit in the trees, and we were just nosing in when we hit the trees. So we hit pretty flat. One wing caught a tree and pulled it off and swung the airplane sideways. And it went down through the trees sideways and hit the ground and then sheared the landing gear off. Then it just came to a stop there. And I had my belt unhooked. And of course, I went flying up into the instrument panel and up in the windshield, cut my nose off. It was just hanging down by my mouth, and I had cuts all over my head. And I was pretty well beat up, but I wasn't knocked cold. And the fire was all around every place. And I couldn't figure out how come we were still alive, because I was supposed to be dead. So I jumped around. I had to go over the back seat to get to the door. And I went to just ram my shoulder against the door, and the door was gone. And I fell out on the ground. So I hollered at this guy I had with me, Hank Olson. I never heard no word, and so I was feeling around in there trying to find him. And finally, I felt his hand, and I grabbed a hold of it and yanked him out the door. He was wrapped up in that sleeping bag, and he was trying to figure out how to get out of it. Everything happened so fast. It seemed a long time, but it's just seconds. So I started dragging him away from the airplane, and I got about maybe 5-6 feet from the airplane, and I passed out colder than a turkey. Well, he was okay, so he got up, and then he drugged away from the airplane, and of course, then there was nothing left of the airplane. Completely burned up. There was a doctor happened to be in town operating on some kids in the mission, taking their tonsils out and stuff. And so he went to work and sewed me all back together. I was still all bandaged up. One eye was bandaged up and still all beat up. And hell, we couldn't, either one of us couldn't even move for about a week. We were so beat up from hitting the ground so hard. Anyway, we didn't have any broken bones, luckily.
Any idea on how the fire started?
Well, I think I had the selector valve was leaking and the belly was full of gas fumes. And when I was making this turn around Enan, it was just about dark and I was trying to attract the rides. I goosed the engine a couple of times. And I think when I goosed the engine, everything was just right that the blew some flames out against the belly of the airplane. And that with that gas in there, I think that's what ignited it, because it went just poof, just that quick.
I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Now let's break for a word from our sponsors. Okay, let's get back to our interview. In this next segment, Wright describes a pilot's nightmare. Their weather was getting bad, but he had no place to land. Let's hear him explain how he got out of this mess.
One time I was headed up there. He called me from here and wanted me to get right up there. My back was on the Bowman, but I went anyway and got to McGrath and gassed up. I was flying a Pacer then, and I was headed up, and the weather wasn't very good, lousy weather. So I was following the Kuskokwim River down, and it was getting late. It was pretty near dark, and the fog was coming down on the river, and I was trying to get to Crooked Creek. There was a guy named Vanderpool that lived there, and he had an airplane. He did some flying out of there, and I was going to try to make it in there that night. The fog kept getting lower and lower. I came around the corner, and I was down in these hills and high trees, and the river isn't very wide, not wide enough to turn around. And so I got myself trapped. I was going down the river, couldn't turn around, and this fog bank came right down to the river. Well, I couldn't go up because I'd be done. I'd hit one of them hills, but I had no instruments in that airplane anyway. So I just shut the engine off and made a blind landing. I landed right in the middle of the river because I was flying down the middle of the river and probably only about 50 feet off the ground. So I was able to make a pretty good landing by just letting the airplane settle down. You know, kept the airspeed up a little high till I thought I was close to the ground. But I landed okay. It was warm, like 20 above. Well, I didn't want to stay out there. I didn't want to make a camp, and I got my snowshoes out, and I snowshoed up the river about a mile or a mile and a half, because I thought I heard dogs barking, and I thought I had to be awful close to Crooked Creek. I snowshoed about that far, and then I came back and got in the airplane, and I turned the landing light on, and I taxied up to the end of my track, because I knew I wouldn't be hitting the riverbank. You couldn't see a damn thing. You couldn't see 20 feet in front of you. Then I stopped, and I got out, and I listened, and I couldn't hear any more dogs. I thought, oh, I must have been hearing things. So I threw everything out of the airplane and so I could sleep inside the airplane. Just got everything down, and it was dark by then, probably about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And I was just dozing off to sleep, and the light shined in the window. Now, what the hell happened here? God, it startled me so really bad, and this guy hollered at me, "You okay?" It was a native. And what he did, he heard that darn airplane when I was taxiing it. He went over and told Vanderpool he heard an airplane up the river. And Vanderpool says, "Nah, nobody'd be flying in this kind of weather." He said, "I'm sure I did. I know I heard an airplane." So Vanderpool says, "If you're so sure, why don't you take your dogs and go up and take a look a couple of miles and see if you see anybody?" So he did. He hitched his dogs up and he came up the river. And he was just going to turn around and head back, and he came across my snowshoe tracks. He followed him over to the airplane. So he gave me a ride to Crooked Creek. It was just a couple miles away. So anyway, I didn't have to sleep out. That fog sat there for 4 days. Vanderpool flew me back up there after we cleaned his airplane up. And it was about 2 inches of frost over that whole airplane from that fog. We had a hell of a time. It took us 2 or 3 hours to clean the frost off enough so the airplane would fly.
And I have a rough idea, but how did you go about getting that frost off?
In those days, we didn't have any wing covers. We had engine covers and a fire pot to heat the engine with, like an old plumber's pot. Engine covers went right down to the ground. See, so it was like a little tent in there. But you had to sit in there with it all the time in case it flared up. If it flared up, it would burn your airplane up. And so you stayed in there with it till the airplane was warm, like about an hour, hour and a half, whatever it took to heat the airplane up. You only drained the oil out the night before. And then you could put it on the fire pot and heat it up and dump it back in. But on the wings, we'd take a rope and just throw over the top of the wing and saw it back and forth along the wing, then whop it if there was ice on it, and break the ice loose. It didn't do the fabric too much good, but it cleaned the wing off so where you could fly. Then, of course, the windshield and the tail you could get at by hand, wipe it off and clean it off.
Polar bear hunting on the sea ice was notoriously dangerous. Listen to Al describe some of the challenges.
Went up polar bear hunting a couple of years. Bob Elliott and I went together. But I didn't like that polar bear hunting. It was a dangerous sport because you'd get out on that ice and it'd be moving all the time when you land on it. You had to know how to tell if a lead was froze good enough to land. And it always frosted after it froze over. So you couldn't tell how thick it was. So the way you'd tell is you'd land on the ice. It'd be nice, smooth ice and start slowing up and keep looking back at your tracks. And if moisture started showing in the tracks, you got out of there. If it didn't, you went ahead and stopped, then you never got out of the airplane right away. You'd sit in there for a minute or so and see if this thing was sinking. And if water started coming up around the skis, then you'd goose it and get the hell out of there, because sea ice is different than freshwater ice. It's more flexible. It'll bend more before it breaks. So it'd make a little indentation, and then the water would come up. I knew one kid that went through the ice and drowned. His passenger made it, but they landed after this bear, and they had the cover airplane was flying around. They saw him go through the ice, so they tried to find a place to land, and it was about a half a mile away. It's the only place they could find to land on solid ice. And they had some rope and ran down there as quick as they could. The airplane was gone and the pilot was gone, but the passenger. He was still floating around there in this hole. And they got a rope to him and drug him out. And the only reason that he floated is he had down underwear on and then down pants over the top of it, and down parka, and all his feathers held enough air to keep him afloat and keep him from getting. They got him out and got him to the airplane and back to Barrow. That's the only one I know that lost, but there's been two or three dropped through the ice, and a couple of them got lost and never did find the airplane, had airplane trouble and went back to get it and couldn't find it because it drifted away someplace. And I broke a landing gear out there on the ice one day, but it didn't fall down all the way. The strut broke in between. We landed after a bear, and I had a lot of gas with me. I had about 10 cans of gas in a PA-14 I was flying. So I unloaded the airplane, all this gas out, and piled it up on the ice in a pyramid so I could see it from quite a way. Of course, the bear got away. Then I got a tie-down rope for the airplane and tied the gear together so it couldn't collapse. I think I had an axe in the airplane. I took the handle and wound it up tight and tied the axe to the edge of the gear. And I got off all right and got back to Barrow with my hunter. And then I couldn't find nobody to weld the gear up. So I eventually welded it myself, and I ain't a very good welder, but it held. I went back, and it was only about 15 miles out of Barrow where this happened, and I had a good fix on Barrow with a VOR, so I knew exactly where to go, and the exact course to get to it, and how long it took and everything. I timed it going back in and everything. It was 2 days before I got back out there. And I never did find that gas pile. It drifted away someplace. A lot of times you'd fly around, you'd see your old tracks where you landed, you know, and some of them would be going this way and some of them would be going that way. They'd be old. But, you know, the ice had busted up and refroze.
Al Wright lived in Minto as a boy. In this last segment for today, he explains how our neighbors to the west decided to move their village to its current location.
When they moved that village of Minto, I was really involved in that, helping them get that thing going when they moved from the river to where it is now.
Now tell us a little bit about that. What prompted the move?
Well, the flooding. It flooded every year. And so they were going to try to figure out a place to move to higher ground. And there's a place called the Sand Hills down the river, about 20 miles from Minto, just above Tolovana. They figured it'd be a good site for it. And then they're talking about building the road down there in this North Fork, they call it, to where they're at now. One of the natives had a trapper cabin there. They always stopped there when they came out of the Minto Flat, and there was a lot of berries around there. So they had a vote to decide where to move to, and they decided on that North Fork. So they started to try to figure out how to get a village going there. There was a guy. He worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs that was in charge of Mir. And he was a good friend of mine. I flew him all over the country all the time. And see, they had a sawmill down there across the river from Old Minto that the mission had put in when they built that place that we lived in when we were at Minto. It was a nice two-story log building. My mother was a nurse, and so she took care of everybody's ills. Anyway, they left that sawmill there, and so when it came time to move this village, they started it up again. They were going to saw lumber and make their own houses. Wally Craig, that was the guy's name, that was a BIA guy, he says, well, what we could do, he says, I got a program where I can get $3,000 for each family to put into a house. And I said, well, they got that sawmill. They could cut logs, cut lumber for all these cabins. And that $3,500 would buy all the doors and windows you needed, and you could build some nice houses any size they wanted. So we thought that was a really great idea. Well, then Alaska Housing came along, and they says, no, 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 we're going to build them frame houses. So they had this big meeting, and God, they were arguing back and forth, and they finally decided, well, they'd leave it up to the people which way they wanted to go. Of course, most of the people said, well, we want to live like white men. We want to have a frame house. So the Alaska Housing won out. They built all those houses. Of course, they were just cracker boxes sitting on stilts. They could have ended up with a house for each person, a nice house, and it wouldn't have cost them a penny. They just owned them outright. And these Alaska Housing houses, they charged them $8,000 for each one of them. Of course, they never made the payment. And then eventually they tore them all down and built log houses, and they shipped the logs in from Canada to build the houses. That's our government. That sewer system cost over $1 million, and it never did work. They put it in when it was freezing, and it froze right up the first time somebody run some water in it. They did put a well in, and we built a field right there. Actually, now it's the main street of the village. It's where we had the first landing field. Wasn't a very good field. Ran uphill and was narrow and rough. But we went in there with Helios and a 180.
That's all for today. Join us again next week when we hear from another veteran outdoorsman.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.